earlier this fall, the State Police Investigators Association selected Timothy Diamond to serve as their president. To learn more about the 1,200-member union, including some of their key issues for 2021 and beyond, we spoke with Senior Investigator Diamond earlier this month. We began our conversation by discussing what police investigators in the state actually do.
Our guys do some of the coolest, most innovative things in police work. Our people handle counterterrorism investigations. They handle forensic investigations. They work homicides. We have undercover operators. We have gang investigators. We have cybercrime investigators that handle all of the crimes that go on the internet right now. So we have a very dynamic group of people that were all at one point New York State troopers. They're all road troopers, and they've now been promoted to investigator. And then the next step after investigator is you make senior investigator. So a senior investigator supervises the investigators.
And can you talk about your own career in law enforcement, including as an investigator?
So, Dave, this union life is relatively new to me. As I'm sure you know, I was elected a month ago. And prior to that, I have traveled around and worked in a few different PDs in New York. I started in the NYPD from 2005 to 2007. I went to the town of Fallsburg Police Department, which is a town police department in the area I grew up. I worked there for a year. And then I came to the New York State Police in 2008. I worked the road on patrol till about 2012 up in Liberty, New York. And then I was promoted to a backroom investigator. And backroom investigators handle rapes, robberies, homicides, burglaries. And I did that from 2012 till 2014. And in 2014, I got into the community narcotics enforcement team. And I started working as an undercover operator across the lower portion of New York. I was there till 2019 when I was promoted to senior investigator in the violent gang narcotics enforcement team. And I was there until I came to the union.
The state police job that you got in 2008, was that something that you had long coveted, or was this sort of just a change in your career that popped up at the time?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Sullivan County, which is a rural county, and the state police cover much of the county. So they were always a very respected agency, and I know as a kid we all looked up to them. So it was something I wanted to do. So I had to work my way to that point and wait for my number to get called. And while I was waiting for my number to get called, I worked the other jobs and got some field experience that I think has been invaluable in my career.
You said you looked up to them as a youngster. Why was that? Was it just the hat, or was there something more to it?
it was more than the hat. No, they were respected. They carried themselves with professionalism, and they were people that solved problems, and that's something I always wanted to do. So to me, it was the pinnacle of law enforcement, and I wanted to reach that point.
Looking at your CV, I see that you did some undercover work in 2014 as part of a long-term wiretap investigation in the Hudson Valley. What did that consist of?
From 2014 to about 2017, I was doing undercover work for the narcotics unit. It consists of operating in an undercover capacity, so you're acting as if you are a civilian, not a police officer. And it involves parts... quantities of narcotics, heroin, fentanyl, crack cocaine of varying levels. And we use those purchases to work our way into larger criminal networks. So we do those buys of drugs to get to the point where we can infiltrate a street gang, or in the case, in the Bread, White, and Blues case, which was just recently highlighted, that was actually, we had a fire department member. We had multiple retired police officers. So in that case, we worked the case from the bottom, worked our way into it, and we wound up having a really good finish. So
pivoting now to your new responsibilities as head of the State Police Investigators Association, what is your, I guess, primary job here? I mean, what will the 1,200 members be looking to you for?
My job is to provide leadership to them on a host of different issues. not just handling contracts, but handling issues with management, issues with the governor's office. But one of the primary things that I see as important for what I'm doing now is I want to try to change the dialogue that's going on right now between police and the public and the very fractured feeling that we all have. I want to try to improve on that. And that was a big part of why I got involved in the union.
Yeah, what do you envision that effort looking like? I mean, and who do you hope to reach out to as part of that effort?
I think some of the effort is going to be put towards highlighting the positive things we do. I think that our union and our membership specifically, people don't know how much good work is being done out there. And they don't know that you know, because our membership, they're very humble. And even I've been asking them to give me cases so I can try to put them out there to social media so these guys know what we're doing, so the public knows what we do. And it's hard to get them to do it because they're people that they love their work, they care about their work, but they don't really look for the attention side of it. So I think that right now the public doesn't know how much good work is being done out there. And I also think that we need to reach out and let the public know and our state representatives and the Senate and the legislatures, they need to know that there's people in law enforcement that are very reasonable, right? And we can do better. We know we can do better, right? But those conversations aren't being had right now, and there's being moves made with some of the recent legislation. I'm sure you've heard about the 50A and bail reform and discovery reform. There's being a lot of decisions made, and the law enforcement side of the house isn't getting any input in there to say, hey, we can make changes, we can improve, we know this. But it's going to take people from each side to come together and have reasonable conversations and make this thing better, because the way it is now isn't benefiting anyone. It's not benefiting the public, it's not benefiting the police officers. It's a continuous fracture and hostility, and I want to try to do my part to fix that.
You mentioned 50A, the shorthand for state law that was reformed this summer that enables the public to access police disciplinary records that had previously been shielded from public view. It sounds like you aren't a fan of the straight repeal that was enacted by the legislature and the governor. So what do you think would have been a more palatable compromise from your perspective?
A palatable compromise, that's a great way to put it, would have been to have the conversation with reasonable people from the law enforcement field and bring the concerns up. Listen, these personnel files, we feel if your star witness was caught lying in an administrative investigation, you know, in 2 years ago, and now they're testifying for someone's freedom, then I think a reasonable person looks at it and says, hey, this is a founded complaint. He was investigated by his agency and they found that he had lied. I think it's hard to argue that that isn't relevant. The flip side of the coin is if you start to provide all of this information to the public and you start putting out even unsubstantiated complaints where there's no merit to what is being said, it actually is going to encourage people to come forward and file false complaints.
Which is a crime, though, in itself, right?
Which is a crime. But it can turn your proactive police officers. It's a way to deter your proactive police officers. Does that make sense, Dave?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. But, I mean, you're also saying that people will then go out of their way to commit a crime because of this, which I'm really doubtful of. But more importantly, you know, the issue of unsubstantiated complaints. You know, there's been a case, there have been cases where people might have multiple unsubstantiated complaints against them, and the argument would be, well, they're unsubstantiated, so we shouldn't take them seriously. But couldn't that also be a reflection of a review process then that isn't adequate? And therefore, by making it clear that a person might have, say, six complaints, unsubstantiated complaints of sexual harassment, maybe then once that's out there, it gives people a better idea of maybe we need to rethink how we're reviewing this process. So it doesn't seem like we should just throw away and ignore unsubstantiated complaints.
No, Dave, I'm not saying throw away and ignore unsubstantiated complaints. What you described was a pattern of behavior. So if you have a pattern of sexual harassment complaints that are somehow unfounded, I think anyone, including our weakest investigators, would say, we should look into this. I'm saying that when you open the door to every unsubstantiated complaint getting out to the public and going into a court of law, you can compromise witnesses on things that have absolutely no merit. And that's a problem to me.
So you brought up the issue of the criminal justice reforms that lawmakers enacted in 2019, specifically the restricted use of cash bail. From your perspective, philosophically, what do you think of the use of cash bail as a means of pretrial detention?
Cash bail is important to keep the people of New York safe. Now, there are so many different factors and nuances and twists and turns involved with bail that you can't hit them all on the head with one hammer. You know what I mean? This is not a each case fits the same bill. There's the term that everybody says, this person's sitting in jail for stealing a loaf of bread. Well, that, we can all agree, as reasonable people, is not fair and should never happen.
And makes for a good musical.
Right? yes. So I think that I'm in agreement with that, and I think everybody that's reasonable would be there. But is it reasonable for someone that commits a sex crime to be released without bail and walking the streets to commit another sex crime? No, I don't think if our reforms are making the public less safe, and if we're seeing the increased amount of recidivists, then I think that our reforms need to be rethought or reformed.
But that's not the question, though, because that example you give, that person could theoretically be out on the street if they're a multimillionaire, and they're not out on the street, though, if they are just a traditional normal person who can't get, you know, $20,000 together to pay bail. So it seems like your argument you're making is more about using judicial discretion to weigh a defendant's dangerousness to a community as opposed to their ability to scrounge together money.
Some of it is dangerousness, but you know, this is, in my opinion, that it was pulled from the judge's hands on how to handle these things. And that's why I said in the beginning, you know, it's a case-by-case situation, and they're not all the same. They're not the same. And you're right. Should a wealthy person be able to walk out on the same crime as a person that has no money? That's a case-by-case basis, and that's something that the judge is going to have to determine. But saying that we're going to eliminate bail, eliminate cash bail across the board for pretty much everything but murder and a few other select crimes, I think it is short-sighted, and I think it actually makes the people of New York less safe.
What do you think, though, about determining remand more on a dangerousness standard moving forward to something that judges currently aren't allowed to do and weren't allowed to do previously? You know, when factoring in bail, they're not supposed to consider dangerousness.
Yeah, it's supposed to be to return them to
exactly.
Make sure they return back to court.
Right.
Yeah. So you're saying let them have a little more of a voice in that topic.
Yeah, let them determine remand based on dangerousness and, you know, their track record and not based on, you know, their ability to pay.
That's a conversation that needs to be had. But my concern is that these conversations weren't had, mm-hmm. and these reforms are being muscled forward. And like I said in the beginning, we can do better. But if there's no conversation, then these topics they get pushed through. And I think that at the end of 2020, when we see the crime rates across the state of New York, I think you're going to be able to tie back a lot of these reforms to these very, very sharp spikes in violent crime.
We're seeing crime spikes, though, in states all over the country, though, and many of which have not implemented the bail reform that we've done. I mean, it seems like some of this could be attributed to the unprecedented pandemic we are currently living through that's been in place for almost the entire bulk of these reforms.
Yeah, I can't speak to the other states because I don't know what reforms they have, but I know that we've had some very drastic reforms in 2020, and now we're seeing very, very high violent crime spikes across the state.
And so, are there examples, though, where a lot of these violent crimes have been committed by people who are out on crimes where they traditionally would have been held with bail?
You know, I don't have the examples offhand. If I was given probably 10 or 15 minutes, I could research it and get it back to you.
But you're saying you're saying that bail is the reason for the spike, though. So that would mean then that it's people who are out because they're not paying bail are the ones committing these crimes.
Yes, bail reform is one of the reasons, Dave. I want to make sure that is clear.
Okay.
Bail reform is one of the reasons that you're seeing a spike. And I can tell you that there are cases right now of persons that are out on bail from bail reform that have committed follow-up crimes.
What do you think of the governor's use of the state police force in the last decade?
I think that I can only speak to the experience I've had in the state police.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he's utilizing them to the way that he sees best fit for the state. And I think that if you took five different people, you would get five different opinions on how to utilize our manpower. So I know that the membership, for the most part, is happy with their working conditions. So I can't say that he's doing them wrong, but that's his choice, not mine.
You mentioned some of your responsibilities, and you brought up the issue of contracts. The state currently has a multi-billion dollar budget hole, and Governor Cuomo has been contemplating across-the-board spending cuts in response to this if the federal government doesn't come through with billions of dollars to make up the gap. What could that approach to balancing our budget, these drastic cuts, mean for your members?
It's gonna mean doing more with less, I'm sure. And I'm looking ahead. I can see that if budgets are cut, there's usually a reduction in manpower, and we are stretched pretty thin as it is in the BCI. So I would hope that it doesn't come to that, but I can see it coming to that. And when you're in a fiscal crisis, you know, everybody has to buckle down, and we're going to do the best that we can with what we have.
In terms of the ramifications of cuts, do you think that could mean a smaller workforce, or would it manifest itself in other ways?
It could mean a smaller workforce. It could mean less equipment, less resources. It could mean all that. And I frankly don't know enough about the state budget to know where that it's going to go.
We've talked a little bit about some of the legislation that's made it through its way through the Capitol in the last 2 years. Moving forward now with yourself in this new role, how are you going to go about, you know, engaging Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and the top Democrats on these criminal justice issues so that you actually have a voice in this process? Because I know that they are, I would say, skeptical of some concerns raised by law enforcement. So how do you build that trust and develop a relationship where you are playing an integral role in future legislation?
Mm-hmm. I think you build it by having the conversations that we're having right now, Dave. And I think that if some of the members of government would kind of say, hey, we're about to make big changes involving a profession. Let's get some inside insight on their thoughts on some of these changes. Now, I think that a lot of times politicians, they hear the squeaky wheel. So there's a lot of people in law enforcement that are beating the drum of we're right, you're wrong. And that's it. And I tend to see things a little differently. I tend to think that we can all improve. We can do better, and we're going to get better. And if any of them are listening, or if they would like to have a conversation, I am more than willing to have it. And I bring a pretty unique background in law enforcement to the table. So I think that we could make some significant progress.
We've been speaking with Senior Investigator Timothy Diamond, who was recently elected president of the 1,200-member New York State Police Investigators Association. And I look forward to talking to you over the next 3 years of your term. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thanks, Dave. You have a good day.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.